Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink, with another installment of the Christogenos Show. This evening, we are going to be continuing our series on the book of Ezekiel. Tonight is part 13. And my calendar is right. It's October 1st. And we only got 30 more days till Halloween. Right? We're all looking forward to that, right? So we can put on our costumes and pretend to be goblins.
But, I thought Russell Walker was going to take the mask off.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a hobgoblin for you. And so, but this evening, our intention is to get into Ezekiel chapter 36. But we have a bit of recapping to do. Bill, I understand you want to go back and do some recapping in Ezekiel 34.
Well, Ezekiel 34 is one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. It is extremely important to understanding the phrase lost sheep in the New Testament.
Okay.
Are you ready for me? All right.
Yeah, sure.
In Ezekiel chapter 34, we saw that the Bible itself defines the phrase, which is rendered in the New Testament as lost sheep.
Right.
And the Greek phrase can more accurately be demonstrated to mean driven off sheep,
mm-hmm.
and that is also how it is defined here. The phrase is used only in Ezekiel 34 of the literal children of Israel,
mm-hmm.
who were driven off from Yahweh's sight. And because no other people were ever driven off, then no other people except these literal and genetic children of Israel
right.
can ever claim to have been either lost or sheep.
Okay.
And the new covenant, as we also see, was a subject of Ezekiel's prophecy here
right.
at Ezekiel 34:25, and that can only apply to genetic and literal Israel
right.
because Yahweh says in that passage that he would make with them a new covenant.
Right.
And it is further evident that there are three witnesses, three New Testament witnesses relating the ministry of Christ to this very chapter
mm-hmm.
of prophecy. And therefore to the racial exclusivity of the gospel.
Right.
And here are those three witnesses.
Okay.
Reading Ezekiel 34:11, all right, says, "For thus says Yahweh God, behold, I will both search my sheep and seek them out."
Mm-hmm.
And Yahshua must have had this very passage in mind
yes.
in Matthew 15:24, where he said he came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Yes.
The second witness at Ezekiel 34:16.
16, yes.
All right. The Old Testament says, "I will seek that which was lost," and here's the where I say it defines what that word means,
yeah.
"and bring again that which was driven away." And Yahshua Christ said that he would come to seek and to save that which was
mm-hmm.
lost,
yes.
past tense. That's two witnesses.
Right. Well, it's interesting that my King James Version here is copiously cross-referenced, you know, for between the Old and New Testaments, but it has nothing here with
well, they don't want us
yeah.
to know the truth.
Right, exactly, because Jesus said several times, "I come not but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You'd think they'd put that cross-reference right here.
Well, right. It never says the Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost and whoever else wanted to
right.
have it.
Right. Whoever else claimed to be lost, right.
Now, the third witness is at 34:17, where Yahweh said he would judge between the rams and the goats, and we see that too is a mission of the returning Christ at the second advent in Matthew chapter 25,
right.
where he says he will judge between the sheep and the goats.
That's right. That's right.
So basically, the New Testament and the Old Testament are one book. The Bible itself consistently refutes so-called
right.
replacement theology,
right.
which is really what replacement theology really is. It's a replacement of the true Christianity with the false God of the Jews.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because the Jews claim to be the Israel of the Bible, and they're not. And anybody who believes that lie automatically will fail to understand Scripture. Okay. Well, then, and then, of course, chapter 35 begins to talk about the goats.
Well,
right?
Well, right. And in Ezekiel 35, I made the proposition that just as Zion is a literal mountain where Israel once dwelt, mm-hmm. that its name is used metaphorically to represent the children of Israel, and as you like to say, their government, which makes sense. Seir is also the name of the literal mountain where the Edomites once dwelt,
mm-hmm.
and here its name is used to metaphorically describe the descendants of Esau wherever they go. And,
right.
and even regardless of that, but we'll see the chapters 35 and 36 of Ezekiel explain the takeover of the formerly Israelite lands by the Edomite enemies of Israel.
Right.
This is the true replacement theology.
Right.
That in the 6th and 5th centuries B.C., the Edomites took over Palestine. In the 2nd century B.C., they were all converted to Judaism. That's the true replacement theology.
That's right.
As the historian Josephus and the apostles attest, and they have been trying to replace true Israel with their own bastard
mm-hmm.
children ever since.
That's right.
And the people known as the Jews today are the true enemies of Yahweh our God.
Okay, okay. All right, it appears we have a troll. Okay. We'll see. He's not listed. I'll have to figure something out here.
Just click on the
yeah.
Mute all guests button, and we'll be better off.
Okay. All right. Oh, he left. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'll do that. Okay. Well, let's see. Yeah, I see. Okay. I'll click the red button on the right of the top screen. Let's see if he comes again. I'll do that. Okay, very good. He left.
Well, that's my recap of 35 anyway.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and, you know, we can certainly see that, well, in verse 5, chapter 35, verse 5, because you have had speaking to the Edomites, because you have had a perpetual hatred and have shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword in the time of their calamity, in the time that their iniquity had an end, of course, being the Amalekites and other Edomites that began to make war with the Israelites as they were coming out of Egypt. Okay? So that's just one episode. But, I think you brought up the Doeg, the Edomite, did the dirty deed for Saul by killing a bunch of Israelite priests, and when no Israelite would actually do the job. Okay, so I'm going to have to I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to get no, I shouldn't have
All the way in the upper right-hand corner, there's a button.
Yeah, okay.
Mute all guests.
Okay, you're back. It could take some time to block guests. Okay. All right. All right. Well, 18 says he can't be blocked. We'll find out. Okay. So anyway, so in chapter 35, at verse 15, which is the last verse. Actually, let me go back to verse 12 and read the last four verses here.
Balaam.
Yeah.
It's basically just that it's telling the story of the Edomites taking over
right.
the two lands of Judah and Israel, and says that explicitly in verse 10.
Yes, yeah. And here, as in the book of Obadiah and in various other places, the Edomites and or Idumeans are identified as the main enemies of Israel, okay? And to me, it's quite astounding that none of the Judeo-Christian theologians pay any attention to this, that there's no discussion whatsoever in mainstream Christianity about who are these people and why does Yahweh hate them, right? No discussion. But let me read the last four verses here. Ezekiel 35, 12 through 15. And you shall know that I am Yahweh and that I have heard all your blasphemies. And that's all the Jews do is blaspheme Yahweh. The rabbis train themselves in their yeshivas to blaspheme Yahweh and blaspheme us, which you have spoken against the mountains of Israel, saying they are laid desolate, they are given us to consume. Now, of course, it's the Edomites that are descendants of Esau who hated Jacob because Jacob supposedly stole his birthright. But that's not true. Esau offered it to him for a mess of pottage. And all Jacob did was say, okay, here, I'll give you a mess of pottage for your birthright.
Well, and that was really only, I know how it reads in Genesis.
Yeah.
But in reality, that seems to me to only be, and Comparé said this first, the ceremony officiating his giving up of the birthright, because he despised it
That's
in the
right.
first place. He had
despised.
Already taken Canaanite wives. His mother had already expressed trouble over those Canaanite wives. He saw his father's displeasure. He thought he could fix the situation by taking Ishmaelite wives,
yes.
which only exacerbated the situation.
Right, right. And it didn't. He still did not do right by the law and
no,
by Yahweh.
No, he didn't
and by
go
Yahweh.
To his father and say, Father, who should I marry?
Right.
Where should I get a wife?
Right, yeah. Let me get rid of these Canaanite wives and I'll do right. That thought apparently never occurred to him. He was a rebel from the beginning, okay?
And that's why Paul calls Esau. He doesn't talk, Paul, about really him being a bad person because he sold his birthright.
Right.
He calls him a profane man and a fornicator.
Right.
That means a race mixer in Paul's language.
That's right. That's right. Because he took Canaanite wives instead of Israelite wives. Okay.
And that's why he sold his birthright. And that's right. In Hebrews, I think, chapter 12.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Verse 13. Again, speaking to these Edomites, thus with your mouth you have boasted against me and have multiplied your words against me. I have heard them. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, when the whole earth rejoices, I will make you desolate. It seems to me that the structure of this verse is reversed. It should be, I will make you desolate, and then the whole earth will rejoice, right? I think that's the way this verse should read. I imagine the King James translators got this wrong. Verse 15, as you did rejoice at the inheritance of the house of Israel, that is because they took it from us, they stole it from us, because it was desolate, so will I do to you. You shall be desolate, O Mount Seir, and all Idumea, even all of it, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Okay, we will know that Yahweh is true to his word when he destroys the nation of Esau, which is, of course, the Jews today.
Well, right, and we have to, the Jews have imposed global banking tyrannies over every nation on earth. And the only nations on earth that aren't under the global banking tyranny are Iran, Iraq, Libya, and they're that's the real reason why war is constantly being made with these nations.
That's right.
Now the whole Arab Muslim division in Palestine, I believe, is all being orchestrated by the Rothschilds.
Oh, sure.
And the Israelis have been using the Muslims against the West for 1,500 years now.
Oh, yeah.
Islam is basically a religion invented by the Jews to herd the mongrel people into a pen where they can use them against Christendom.
Right.
That's the way I see the big picture. And that's
sure.
the way it's played out.
Yeah.
For 1,500 years.
Yeah,
we are being told, hate the Muslims in the Middle East, love the Muslims that are flooding our country here.
Right,
and
love the Jews no matter where they are.
Yeah, right. Well, the average American, who's the average Westerner, I should say, because it's all over Christendom,
right.
who these Muslims are being forced upon, has no say in the matter. And we're sending our sons over there to die trying to kill them.
That's right.
And we have to accept them here. And the average Westerner never sees that dichotomy.
Right. Yeah.
Well, why can't they see that? That's a cognitive dissonance
right.
of the first magnitude.
Yeah,
the
Hegelian dialectic. You know, they can't see that the dialectic between the so-called left and the so-called right is being manipulated by a puppeteer, okay?
Well, right. I believe the entire Middle East war has been orchestrated since the Balfour Declaration.
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely no doubt. Yeah, now, and for people who think, who've never heard this before, they might think that you're really going off the deep end by suggesting that that Islam is being manipulated by the Jews against the West, but that's absolutely the case. even though Muhammad, when he first tried to form his new religion, Muhammad was illiterate. And so he had to hire people to write things down for him. And what he did was he hired Jews, you know, and they actually copied portions of the Old Testament and incorporated them into the Quran. And, of course, they made changes to create this new religion. So even though Muhammad himself was not a Jew, he actually did hire Jews to write the Quran. That's the bottom line. And since he was illiterate, he really had very little idea what they were writing in there. And he may have instructed them to write this and write that. But essentially, the Quran is a Jewish book. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Well, the Quran's a Jewish book. The Jews used the Muslims against the Byzantine Empire. It was the Jews that brought the Moorish Muslims into Spain. It was the Jews that opened the gates of the city to the Golden Hordes. And we end up with an entirely Muslim Eastern and Southern Russia. And all of that was perpetrated by the Jews. Martin Luther wrote about it. It's very evident in history. According to Maurice Pinier wrote an excellent book on the plot. He called it The Plot Against the Church. It's from a Catholic perspective, but it tells an excellent story about the Jewish perfidy against the Goths of Spain and how they destroyed that nation.
Yes.
And because they couldn't infiltrate it, that they brought the Muslims against it. It's all in a matter of prophecy, as we'll see when we get to Ezekiel 38 and 39. However, it's the Jews who have been behind it. The serpent and the flood that he releases from his mouth against the woman, that's the Jews and their use of the other races against us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's go into chapter 36 of the book of Ezekiel. Also, you son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel, that is to the leaders of Israel, the government of Israel, and say, you mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh Elohim, because the enemy has said against you, aha, even the ancient high places are ours in possession. And, of course, this book of Ezekiel was written as the 12 tribes, or just after the 12 tribes, I'm sorry, the 10 tribes had been taken into captivity by the Assyrians, and as the two-tribe house of Judah was being ready to get deported by the Babylonians, correct?
Actually, Ezekiel 36, even though the scrolls are all in the wrong order,
uh-huh.
Ezekiel 36 was written right after the deportations at Jerusalem.
Okay, so right after the house of Judah was deported? Okay.
I have a note in here on it somewhere, a chronology note, but I have 6 pages of notes, right? We're not up to that part yet.
Okay, well, yeah, if you find it, let me know. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, because the enemy has said against you, aha, even the high places are ours in possession, therefore prophesy and say, thus says Yahweh, because they have made you desolate, and swallowed you up on every side, that you might be a possession to the residue of the heathen, and you are taken up in the lips of talkers, and are an infamy of the people. Therefore, you mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, to the mountains, and to the hills, to the rivers, and to the valleys, to the desolate wastes, and to the cities that are forsaken, which became a prey and a derision to the residue of the heathen that are round about. Now he's talking about the Israelites being the derision because we have failed to obey his law. Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, surely the fire of my jealousy have I spoken against the residue of the heathen and against all Idumea. There's Idumea again, which have appointed my land into their possession with the joy of all their heart, with spiteful minds, to cast it out for a prey. Now, I see this verse, Bill, as being a prophecy of the eventual takeover of Judea by the Herodian Edomite Jews, okay?
Well, the Edomites had moved up into Judea by the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And they're not really mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah because Ezra and Nehemiah are, they're focused on Jerusalem. That they don't even hardly mention Galilee, right? Their focus is on Jerusalem. And the relationship with Jerusalem and the Samaritans, and it's not a complete picture of the entire former land of Israel.
Uh-huh.
But the Edomites, it's well known in the profane histories that they had taken over most of what we know from the Bible as southern Judah by the 4th century B.C. and southern Israel by the 4th century B.C. Now, the that they didn't move into Jerusalem and they didn't move into the land around Galilee, and that was probably providential. And Samaria had already been populated by the Assyrians with people from many other tribes.
Yes, yes.
So they really couldn't populate Samaria without ticking off the masters of the empire, right?
Right, right.
And the Persians or the Assyrians or whoever was in charge at any particular time
right.
would have taken recourse. But it's very plain that they inhabited most of southern Judah, the land of Simeon,
yes.
the land of Dan and the southern lands of Manasseh and Ephraim by the 4th century B.C. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's also mentioned in certain apocryphal books I don't have on hand, but I do have that the Edomites were allies of the Babylonians and helped against the siege of Jerusalem.
Right.
And
right.
I could imagine that for that reason they were probably rewarded with those lands by the Babylonians.
Mm-hmm.
That would seem to make historical sense, but I, of course, I don't have any records showing that.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, so it's both a historical statement and a prophetic statement, and it's a multiple prophetic statement because the fact is that the Edomites have been pretending to be Israelites for the last 2,150 years, okay?
Well, that's what I was going to get into next.
Okay.
First, yeah, you know, when we look about, you're taken up in the list of talkers and are an infamy of the people, and what we read in about forsaken cities, and today's parallel would be Youngstown, Detroit, New Orleans, Camden,
right?
You know, and they're all basically forsaken cities. Even New York City is,
yeah.
for the most part, forsaken by our race.
Mm-hmm.
This is paralleling exactly what we're going through today. It was this. It's the same pattern. It's a repeat of the same pattern that went on then, except at that time we were taken out of our land. This time we're being basically pushed out of it.
Right.
And
right.
what we'll see that this can't really be talking about the time of Ezekiel only,
mm-hmm.
since at the time that Ezekiel wrote, the Edomites had not yet quite moved into the land,
right.
and Jerusalem had just been destroyed. And that comes from verse 33:21, that this is being written right after the destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Okay. Ezekiel 34, 35, and 36 are part of that same scroll that he wrote at that time because he doesn't have another date and time that he's given since 33:21, right?
Yeah.
So this is part of the same narrative where Yahweh speaks about the fire of my jealousy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This, the fire of my jealousy, That hasn't happened yet.
Right. Right.
I mean, these races have never been judged by Yahweh except for the particular Edomites at Jerusalem in 70 AD. So where he speaks about the fire of my jealousy, that must be a reference to the coming day of judgment, since we know that from history that the people in true Israel, that those in true Israel, both in the original land and those amongst the nations of true Israel that are amongst us, okay, those people among us who are claiming to be Israel,
mm-hmm.
are actually these very Edomites.
Right.
And so we see something that happened in the 6th century B.C. has been transpiring.
Yes.
Because it was allowed to happen at this time, it's
right.
been transpiring ever since. And I see Ezekiel chapters 35 through, or actually 34 through 39 as an ongoing process,
yes.
which has been carried on since the deportation and punishment of the children of Israel.
Right.
It's because the Edomites were able to infiltrate these lands, to take over these lands,
yes.
and take over basically the Israelite identity from the 2nd century B.C.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of that they're able to do the things that they are doing to us today.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, historically, the House of Judah had frequently employed Edomite scribes and Edomite workmen and Edomite slaves, okay? And these Edomite scribes would have been very familiar with the literature of the true Israelites, okay? And being the descendants of Esau, they would have always had been plotting the revenge of Esau against true Israel, right? So when they got this opportunity that they saw that the house of Judah was taken captive to Babylon, they didn't waste any time in trying to take over the area.
Well, right, and this is setting a historic stage that will unfold over,
yes,
over 2,500 years until,
yes,
our very day.
Yeah, well, because as the host tries to expel the parasite, sometimes the parasite does get expelled, and the host revives and recovers to build a new civilization. But as soon as the host builds a new civilization, the parasite comes along and infects the host again, right? But let me just quote here, because I think it's pertinent at this point, because we have identified the Idumeans as Jews, and that Jewry is, in fact, the parasitic entity that has always been plaguing through Israel, okay, because the Jews, the Edomites, are the descendants of the Canaanites, the descendants of the Kenites, and the Kenites, the descendants of Cain, right?
Well, right.
So they've always been with us and trying to parasitize off of our prosperity ever since Genesis 3:15. First of all, in the Jewish Encyclopedia, 1925 edition, volume 5, page 41, it states, Edom is in modern Jewry, okay? So they admit that they are Edomites, okay? They don't admit the whole thing, but they do admit that Edom is in modern Jewry, which is an admission that they can't be pure Israelites. And if they're not pure Israelites, they're not Israelites, okay? 1980 Jewish Almanac. Page 3, a brief history of the terms for the Jew in the 1980 Jewish Almanac is the following, quote, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew, unquote. So they're admitting that they are not Hebrews or Israelites. I don't know if they ever deny that they're Shemites, because, you know, they'd be anti-Semitic if they denied that they were Shemites, right?
Well, if they're not Hebrews, where did they come from?
That's right.
And how could they be Shemites?
That's right. They're,
you know,
not.
They poison the water with this false definition of Shemite.
That's
and they
right.
try to make us believe that these Arabs are Shemites.
Mm-hmm.
But because they speak a Semitic language. Which is true. They do speak a language that it is Semitic in its origin, just like Pidgin English is
right.
British,
Latin.
Right?
Right.
just like Puerto Rican is Castilian, right?
Right. Okay.
Or probably worse.
Yeah.
Basically, the word Arab means mixed in Hebrew. So these people can't be true Semites, because they have to be, by the definition of their very name, mixed. And even the word, as it appears in the Hebrew of the Old Testament, is often translated mixed. Mm-hmm. When you read about the mixed multitude in the Exodus who tried to follow the children of Israel out of Egypt, look up that word for mixed multitude, and you will find the word Arab.
Yeah.
It's a word that means multitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's very clear that the word Arab means mixed.
That's right. It also means dark in the Hebrew as well. Okay.
Well, it basically means, as a verb, it means to grow dark.
Okay.
And that is true. But how do white people grow dark?
Right.
That's why it means mixed.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. H.G. Wells, in his Outline of History, quote, it is highly probable that the bulk of the Jews' ancestors never lived in Palestine at all, which witnesses the power of historical assertion over fact. Of course, he's talking about the Khazars, which I'll get into from the Encyclopedia Judaica, volume 10, 1971. Khazars, a national group of general Turkic type, independent and sovereign in Eastern Europe between the 7th and 10th centuries A.D. During part of this time, the leading Khazars professed Judaism. And, of course, many Jewish sites have admitted that the modern-day Jews are at least 90% Khazar, which means that 90% of Jews never, their ancestors never set foot in Palestine at all. Okay.
Or they had one distant grandfather. But let me comment on that.
Yeah.
You know, first, Arthur Koestler gets way too much credit for exposing this, right?
Okay. Yeah,
because
Heinrich
Gretz, a Jewish historian,
mm-hmm.
he was a Jew, there's no doubt about it. He was a liar, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, they don't lie about everything.
Right.
And Heinrich Gretz, in his History of the Jews, which was like 6 or 7 very voluminous books
mm-hmm.
written in the 1840s, gives the same account in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, we like to say that the Jews, the Khazarian, the Ashkenazi Jews are mostly Khazarian, but I would bet that every one of them carries the blood of Esau
yes.
and Mongol blood.
Right.
Because these Khazars were originally white. And there's a people called, I like to call them the Uyghurs, right? And
okay.
that's abusing the pronunciation of the word.
Sure.
It's Uyghurs or something similar to that. And the Uyghurs were a people who were of Chinese, of Asian derivation, who in the uprisings and tumults of ancient China and some of the, you know, the tyrannies of ancient China, these Uyghurs moved west. And the further west they moved, the whiter they became.
Mm-hmm.
Until they met up with us and we called them Turks.
Right.
Right?
And
they're basically an Asiatic people who intermingled with white tribes that were left at the time. And we're talking about that maybe the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries A.D.
Okay.
As these people moved west, the further west they moved, the more white blood they subsumed.
Right, right, yeah.
So,
conquered and intermarried with, yes.
Well, right, and that's the DNA examinations of the European people seem to bear this out, okay? That there's a certain genome that they have in common
right.
but with people from the east, and it seems to bear out the historical fact that the Uyghurs, and I'm sorry, I probably can't pronounce it right, but the Uyghurs are actually derived from a group of people related to the Chinese, mingled with whites, the Edomites.
The Uyghurs.
The Edomites, when they were they were practically barred from doing any business at all the way they like to do business
right.
in Christendom from the time of Constantine and especially Theodosius 1 and 2, and they had migrated to all different extremities of the empire or beyond the borders of the empire to get away from Constantinople and central, you know, the central Byzantine Empire, because they could no longer loan Christians money at interest. They could no longer hold Christian slaves. More importantly, they could no longer hold any governmental positions.
They couldn't practice their religion.
Well, right. The Jews couldn't practice their religion anymore.
Right.
So they had to leave. They couldn't be moneylenders. They couldn't have Christian slaves. And they couldn't be bureaucrats anymore.
Right.
So they had to leave. So they went to Arabia. They went to what we know now as Mauritania and the northern coast of Africa. And they went to Khazaria.
Right.
And the Jews that went to Khazaria converted the Khazars to Judaism. And Heinrich Gretz says they converted one village at a time, and village after village fell under the sway of Judaism.
Right.
Well, there were probably a lot of blonde and Eurasian, and the Jew loves the Eurasian woman, right?
Yes.
They love that blood mixture. They promote it everywhere.
That's right.
And there were probably still a lot of white women in the Khazarian Empire,
yeah.
some of them Scythian, some of them Japhethite, some of them of Persian blood,
mm-hmm.
and the Jews, once these people were converted to Judaism, it opened up the idea of intermarriage with these Edomites.
Yeah, and they used these pretty-looking white women as whores, too.
Well, right, and
mm-hmm.
I would imagine that most of the Khazars probably do have Edomite blood, and they definitely have Mongol blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here, the Jewish Encyclopedia. Khazars, a non-Semitic, Asiatic, Mongolian tribal nation who emigrated into Eastern Europe about the first century, who were converted as an entire nation to Judaism in the 7th century by the expanding Russian nation, which absorbed the entire Khazar population, and who account for the presence in Eastern Europe of the great numbers of Yiddish-speaking Jews in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, Galicia, Bessarabia, and Romania. This is the Jewish Encyclopedia.
Well, right, and it's probably, I won't say that 85% of Jews are Khazars, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong, because it's more accurate to say that probably 80 or 85% of the people who identify themselves as Jews are Khazars.
Okay. Well, the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia disagrees with you, Bill. It says about 92% of all Jews are Ashkenazim. Okay.
Well, they're probably not counting the Ethiopian Jews.
Right.
The Falashes.
Right. One more, and this is good because it's by Alfred Lilienthal in his Zionist Connection 2. And he says, and without the hue and cry, anti-Semitism, pray, what happens to the Zionist movement? Khazar conversion was not unique. Who can say for sure that many Christian readers of this book might not, in fact, have a better claim, which they do not choose to exercise, to go back home to Palestine than Hannah Schemmer, Menachem Begin, or Golda Meir? Queen Victoria herself belonged to an Israelite society that traced the ancestry of its membership back to the lost tribes of Israel. When the word Judaism was born, there was no longer a Hebrew Israelite state.
I'm sorry, where are you reading this from?
This is Alfred Lilienthal, The Zionist Connection 2.
Okay,
just 759 to 750.
That's interesting that this Jew would talk about identity.
Yes, he does. When there was no longer a Hebrew Israelite state, the people who embraced the creed of Judaism were already a mixture of many nations, races, and strains, and this diversification was rapidly growing. Alfred Lilienthal, The Zionist Connection, too. So it's not like the Jews don't know who they are. They definitely know that they're Edomites, Canaanites, and Khazars.
Well, absolutely. And the Sephardic Jews, even though they're a small part of Jewry, that they're also a small part of Catholicism.
Right.
They're a small part of Islam. And when you take the idea of who a Jew is by race, you'll probably find their numbers a hell of a lot larger than 8 to 15% of the Jews, right?
Yeah.
Because most of them are Catholics and Muslims. Okay. Now the Khazars, I would bet that they have a lot more Edomite blood than most people would think, because they've been intermixing.
Sure.
You know, the three or four races that made up the Khazar Jewish Turkish trading empire from 600 to 900 really flourished for 300 or 400 years.
Yes.
And when the Golden Horde came, that basically put an end to that. And many of those people were migrating into the Ukraine and into Europe. But the I would bet with all of those years of basically religious exclusivity in Eastern Europe and intermarrying in Eastern Europe simply based on religious grounds, whether they were a Turk or a Khazar or an Edomite, they were still a Jew.
Right.
That they probably all have Edomite blood in them by now. I would be shocked if they're running.
You mentioned earlier the fact that the Jewish lifestyle had been banned in the Western Roman Empire. Part of my understanding is that many of these Jews went to the Eastern Empire.
Well, no, they were banned in the Eastern Empire. Jew was an Eastern emperor. Yes,
oh, okay. Sir. Okay. Right. That's true. That's right. And, and when they were, and many of these were Edomites, okay, and then when they were banned from Christendom altogether, that's when they had to move north, and south and east.
Well, right, and there were many Jews that moved into Spain
right.
and Italy who had a jolly time there while they were banned from the Eastern Roman Empire.
Right, okay.
And after the decrees of Justinian, it was the first Roman popes, I hate to recognize them as popes, but not all of them were screw-ups.
Right.
And a lot of them had actually, did the same things that Theodosius did and forced the Jews out of society.
Right.
Which is why the Jews brought the Moors into Spain.
Right, right, yeah. So that the Sephardic Jews who had already infiltrated Roman society and the Eastern Roman society as well, when they were expelled, many of them moved into Khazaria and interbred with the Khazarian, Mongol, Asiatic Turks, right?
Yes.
So that the Khazars would have a fairly large proportion of Edomite blood.
Well, that's why I say that, and I've said it here before, you take all the DNA in the world and throw it into a blender,
right,
and pour it out, and what you have left is a Jew.
Right, right. And they all practice the same religion, which is that, what's the term again, that replacement theology, that Judaism replaced the law of Moses with, right?
Well, right. That, and it's the satanic DNA of those original rebels,
right,
who have basically leached into every foul beast and
right,
everything they could get their hands on, they've mixed with, and that's what a Jew is.
And their tactics have not changed at all in the last 2,000 years. They're still practicing the same game of using money to subvert nations and cause them to behave like Jews, right? Now, they've been doing this for 2,000 years, and the Christians still haven't caught on to the game because they believe the lie that the Jews are the Israelites of the Bible, right?
Well, right. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible how amazing how they have been able to fool an entire planet. But, of course, that was prophesied.
Well, they're able to fool that entire planet because they simply don't read.
Yeah, the Christians don't read. Yeah.
Knock and you will find.
Right.
Well, that
they don't ask.
That means that first you have to knock.
All right. But if you knock on a Judeo-Christian pastor's head, you'd get a hollow sound.
Well, right. But that's why that's why we had a Reformation.
Right.
Because men started reading the Bible.
That's right.
That is why
this country
was built. When the English started tyrannizing Americans, these men were learned men that read their Bible.
That's right.
And realized that they were being enslaved.
Mm.
Today we're enslaved, and we don't even know it. And we're enslaved 100 times more than the King of England wanted to enslave the colonists.
Yes. Okay, so let's continue with Ezekiel chapter 36. Let me read 5 again because we have been discussing 5 for a long time here. Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, surely the fire of my jealousy have I spoken against the residue of the heathen and against all Idumea. Why don't the pastors ever identify who Idumea is, which have appointed my land, that is ancient Palestine, into their possession with the joy of all their heart, with spiteful minds, we're talking about Edomite Jews here, to cast it out for a prey. And this is what Jews have been doing to true Israel for the last 2,000 years, folks. And actually, we're talking here 586 B.C., so 2,500 years, 2,600 years. Verse 6.
Now, let me say something before you get into 6.
Yeah.
And Yahweh here in 6 is actually talking to the land.
Okay.
The land itself.
Right.
And if you'll see that, it'll become evident as we proceed.
Yeah.
And he's making the land a promise.
Okay.
It will one day be cleansed of its shame.
Right.
But, which is the shame caused by the sinful people who dwelt upon it.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Verse 6. Prophesy therefore concerning the land of Israel, and say to the mountains and to the hills, to the rivers and to the valleys. And of course, that's not just ancient Palestine, but even America and Europe and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, wherever Israelites are being infested by parasitic Jews. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I have spoken in my jealousy and in my fury, because you have borne the shame of the heathen.
Or the nations.
Yes, the nations, yes. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, I have lifted up my hand. Surely the heathen that are about you, they shall bear their shame. Of course, so shall we.
Now that's pointing to those in Ezekiel's time, to those nations around the land of Israel shall bear their shame. But it also fits hand in hand with Ezekiel 38 and 39 and the promised cleansing of Israel.
Right, right. Yeah, and of course, the cleansing of Israel, cleansing of the planet, is yet to come. The entire planet will be cleansed. And of course, our people, to the extent that we are in bed with the Jews, need also a tremendous cleansing. And that cleansing is coming, folks, too. Verse 8. But you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people of Israel, for they are at hand to come. For behold,
the people are going to come.
Yes.
These Israelites were just deported, right?
Right.
And here, the people are going to come to the mountains of Israel, and it can't be talking about Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And the I'd like to read the NAS version here. It says, but you, O mountains of Israel, will put forth your branches
right.
and bear your fruit for my people Israel, for they will soon come.
Uh-huh.
But it's not talking about Palestine. It's talking about those mountains that Yahweh foresaw the Israelites dwelling in, I believe.
Right.
And it's a prophecy about how fruitful they are going to be when they arrive at those places.
Right. Well, this is the same expression, shoot forth your branches, that is used of Ephraim and Manasseh. And, of course, Ephraim and Manasseh shot their branches all the way across the Atlantic Ocean to America, right? And so, yeah, this expression, shoot forth your branches, is talking about, excursions. And they don't come back from the they keep on moving west. So, yeah, definitely this is talking about future time, the future migrations of the 12 tribes. Absolutely. Verse 9, for behold, I am for you, and I will turn to you, and you shall be tilled and sown. And I will multiply men upon you, all the house of Israel, even all of it. And the cities shall be inhabited, and the waste shall be built. Now, of course, ancient Palestine was not a waste. It was a thriving, under David and Solomon, a thriving, metropolis. The whole country was world famous. It was absolutely thriving, and it was not yet a waste. It had just become a waste in 586 B.C. And I will multiply upon you man and beast.
Well, I think the beast here is probably the necessary beast.
Right, right. And they shall increase and bring fruit, and I will settle you after your old estates and will do better to you than at your beginnings, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. And, of course, throughout the migration period, the white race, the Christian Israel white race, has expanded and blossomed and created civilization, modern technology, medicine, you name it. We have definitely branched out and created, a wonderful, fruitful civilization. Verse 12.
Well, let me say that after your old estates doesn't really mean in your old estates, right?
Uh-huh, right.
And in the NAS it says, and I will cause you to be inhabited as you were formerly and will treat you better than at the first.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Verse 12, yea, I will cause men to walk upon you, even my people Israel, and they shall possess you, and you shall be their inheritance, and you shall no more hereafter bereave them of men. Now, of course, this reminds me of Isaiah, I think, 53:51, I think is the verse, where the Israelites will lay down and become the doormats of the other races, right? Okay. I will cause men to walk upon you.
I think he's still talking to the land.
Okay. Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. Yes. And they shall possess you, and you shall be their inheritance, and you shall no more hereafter bereave them of men. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, because they say to you, you land, devour up men, and have bereaved your nations. Okay. Verse 14, therefore you shall devour men no more, neither bereave your nations anymore, says Yahweh Elohim. So, in other words, is this talking to Palestine that it will no longer?
I think he's still talking to the land.
Right.
And it's not bereaving men anymore because men haven't dwelt there in
right.
I don't know how long. That not Adamic men in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
However, he's still talking to the land, and I think he's making a promise that's still in our future.
Okay. Okay.
And here we'll actually see that nations is used of Israel in the plural.
Mm-hmm.
And where he says in verse 15, neither will I cause men to hear thee in the shame of the heathen anymore. It's actually the shame of the nations anymore. That word heathen is sometimes abused by the King James, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So verse 15. Neither will I cause men to hear in you the shame of the heathen any more, neither shall you bear the reproach of the people any more, neither shall you cause your nations to fall any more, says Yahweh. Moreover,
now cause thy nations to fall had to be Israel and Judah, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the reproach of the people is the reproach of the Israelite people. I mean, it wasn't the reproach of the heathen.
Right, right, right. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, when the house of Israel dwelled in their own land, they defiled it by their own way and by their doings. Their way was before me as the uncleanness of a removed woman.
Okay. Well, that's a woman who's forced to sit apart because of the time of month where in the law,
mm-hmm.
women were told to separate themselves from the
okay.
household.
Okay.
Right? And that was actually a burden they had to bear under the law.
Right.
Separated from the household during the time of their menstruation.
Right.
And
right.
as we shall see, it's because the Israelites were literally said to be shedding blood, which is what a woman does in that time.
Right, right. Okay, verse 18. Wherefore I poured my fury upon them for the blood that they had shed upon the land for their idols wherewith they had polluted. Of course, this involved sacrificing in many cases, their firstborn sons to the fires of Moloch, and so they were literally shedding the blood of their own children. Verse 19, and I scattered them among the heathen, and they were dispersed through the countries according to their way and according to their doings. I judged them.
Now that could very much be, I scattered them among the nations, right?
Yes.
But meaning Assyria, Media, Persia.
Right, okay. Verse 20, and when they entered to the heathen where they went, they profaned my holy name when they said to them, these are the people of Yahweh and are gone forth out of his land. Of course, if we're practicing idol worship, we don't qualify to utter his name. Verse 21, but I had pity for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the heathen where they went. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says Yahweh, I do not this for your sakes, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the heathen where you went. And I will.
Oh, Yahweh fulfills his promises for the sake of his name.
Right.
In spite of our not deserving his mercy.
Right. Right. But he also did not want us blaspheming his name any longer, and which our people were doing, and therefore he took his name out of our mouths, okay? Verse 23, and I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the heathen, which you have profaned in the midst of them, and the heathen shall know that I am Yahweh, says Yahweh, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes. Okay, so the other nations will see our restoration. Verse 24, for I will take you from among the heathen, and gather you out of all countries, and will bring you into your own land.
Which cannot be Palestine.
That's right.
Because Palestine had been taken over by the Edomites.
Right.
And that was a matter of prophecy, so it had to be fulfilled.
Right. And certainly the 12 tribes that migrated never returned back to Palestine.
No, and the 42,000, which is a pittance of people
compared
that returned from Jerusalem, weren't from the whole house of Israel.
Right.
They were from Judah, Benjamin, and Levi.
Right.
That's a distinctly separate line of prophecy that can't be allowed to hear what's being said here.
Yeah. I'd never thought about this, but in your estimation, how many millions of Israelites wound up migrating, across and around the Caucasus Mountains? Have any idea?
Well, first, I would say that's where the first 144,000 came, right?
Okay, well, yeah.
And we'll see that when we cover the Revelation. However, there were probably – that there's one inscription that says that 24,000, perhaps, people were taken from Samaria.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that only 24,000 people were taken from Israel.
Right.
That's only the city of Samaria. the 24,000 people were taken. And that is one captivity of the children of Israel out of many.
Yes.
That it was, there was a constant stream of Assyrian, you know, Assyrian campaigns and deportations of Israelites from the various parts of Israel,
mm-hmm.
starting with the certain cities in the Transjordan region of Reuben and the other half of Manasseh and Gad, right? It began with that, and it took perhaps 65 years, according to prophecy, in 65 years, Ephraim will cease to be a nation. And we see that the last Assyrian campaigns in Palestine were conducted by Esarhaddon
mm-hmm.
as late as 676 B.C.
Right, yeah. So are we talking millions? How many millions?
Well, I would think that we're probably talking several hundred thousand.
Okay.
But sure. Many Israelites had already left Palestine by sea.
Right.
And they were in Spain, they were in Britain, they were in Ireland, they were in Italy, they were in Greece. They've been leaving for 700 years.
Mm-hmm.
The entire time of the existence of ancient Israel, people were migrating out, emigrating by sea out of ancient Israel.
Yeah, and those were the Celtic Israelites. Yeah.
Right. But the people, the several hundred thousand people taken from Israel, and it's at least several hundred thousand more taken from Judah by the Assyrians. I mean, we're talking, what was it, 46 fenced cities?
Yes.
So we have to figure a city that's big enough to have a fence, which isn't a cyclone fence. It actually intones a wall that with towers that men could stand on and fight from and watch from. And probably, in many cases, large enough for a chariot to transverse. And these walls were quite large. I mean, they were no joke.
Mm-hmm.
And around the average city. In fact, we see Paul in Damascus being lowered out of a window in the wall.
Yeah.
Down, you know, a couple of stories probably to escape the people that wanted to kill him, right?
Yeah.
And that's what the typical city looked like, because they had to protect themselves from the roving bands of Arab marauders, which was very common. And at sundown, the gates to the city were locked, and nobody got in or out until sunrise.
Yes.
Now, these were the Assyrians took 46 of them from Judah alone.
Right.
And if the average one had a population of 5,000 people, that's 230,000 people.
Yeah, right there. It's a couple hundred thousand, right.
Yeah. And 5,000 is probably a severe underestimate.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably more like 10.
Right.
Now
that's
Jerusalem,
just Judah. Israel was much larger at the time. Right.
There's one, if I remember properly, I think it was about 200,000 to 300,000 people were deported from Jerusalem.
Okay.
Now Jerusalem in Josephus' time, he says that 1.1 million people were slain by the Romans during the Roman War, and like a million of them only in Jerusalem alone.
Uh-huh.
And Jerusalem held 4 million people,
probably at
her peak.
Right, right.
And I wouldn't doubt if that's how many people it held, or darn close to it, at the time of Hezekiah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we're probably talking about a couple of million people from 745 B.C. to 586 B.C. that decided to go west, and you know, had their fill of the Middle East and went west, right? We're still getting our fill of the Middle East, right? Even today. Okay, verse 24, "For I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all countries and will bring you into your own land." Of course, that is Western Europe, America, etc. "Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and you shall be clean from all your filthiness, and from all your idols will I cleanse you." Now, this, to me, is certainly an oblique reference to the Reformation, when the true Israelites of Europe threw off the shackles of popery.
Well, right, and I think this is still not wholly fulfilled. And it probably won't be until the second incarnation.
That's right.
And that's probably what it's talking about.
Right.
This is a very long-range prophecy.
Right.
This is why I believe that these prophecies had Ezekiel 34 about seeking the lost sheep through Ezekiel 39 describe the wars conducted by the enemy against us throughout the entire period of our coming punishment.
Right.
Because Ezekiel's writing at a time when that period, that 2,520 years, is just beginning.
Yes.
And we have never given up idolatry. That's something that the Scythian Israelites of the deportations, they never gave up idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul says, the things that the nations, meaning lost Israel, sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God.
Yes.
That's what Paul says. So we can't imagine that these people ever gave up idolatry.
No, they haven't.
And certainly
we
can't describe the Jews. And,
right.
And the Jews weren't sacrificing to Apollo or building temples to a Thor or an
right.
Odin or a, a Jupiter or a Zeus
right.
Or an Aphrodite or anything like that. The Jews never did those things, and they're the things Paul describes that Israel is doing.
Right.
So we have to imagine that this prophecy still is not fulfilled. Maybe the Reformation was the beginning of it,
right.
Because that's finally when some of our people put away their idols.
Right. Very good.
Because Catholicism was only the replacement of pagan idols with pagan idols
with more pagan idols.
With
Catholic pagan idols, right.
Right.
Yes, very good. All right, 26. A new heart also will I give you. And a new spirit will I put within you. And, of course, that was received at the redemption at the cross. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them. Okay, so we've discussed this before, but it's appropriate to this verse here, that even those paganized Israelites of the Greco-Roman world had a very lawful and just society by and large, didn't they?
Well, right. And Paul commended the Romans in, even though it's very poorly translated in the King James Version, Paul commended the Romans in Romans chapter 2 because that they built a society apart from the law. Remember, the Romans, their ancestors had left Palestine before Mount Sinai. They left from Egypt before the law was handed down at Mount Sinai. That's the Dardan branch of Zarahemla.
Right.
That's why they had to be grafted back in, because they were a wild olive tree.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up without the law and the prophets.
Yeah,
as
they were not with Moses. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they built, regardless of their wildness, that they still built a society based on the rule of law.
Yes.
And Paul commends them for that in Romans chapter 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Verse 28, and you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers.
Now this can't mean this can't mean Palestine.
Right, okay.
2 Samuel 7:10.
Yes.
That, you know, that Israel would be moved to another place where they will where they will move no more once they get to this other place, this
right.
place other than Palestine.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk about Deuteronomy 32:8 real quick.
Okay.
When the Most High divided the nations, he separated, I'm reading from the Septuagint, he separated the sons of Adam, and that happened in Genesis chapter 10, right?
Yep.
He set the bounds of the nations according to the numbers of the children of Israel.
Of Israel, right.
And that's Deuteronomy 38, and I started reading from the 7th.
Yeah, because we are the nation builders, yes.
Now right, well the Palestine was not, there was no room in Palestine for the children of Israel. They had to they had to squeeze themselves in. With the Canaanites, they were supposed to destroy and never did. The Rephaim, the Philistines, the Cushites, the Babylonians had footholds there, had control and rule there. The Egyptians at various times had control and rule there. There were a whole lot of other people inhabiting that land.
Yes.
That land wasn't left empty for the children of Israel, as Deuteronomy 32:8 infers. So there had to be another land that was left empty for the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assert that that was the land to the west and north of the Danube.
Right, right. Well, we could certainly interpret our fathers, if this is indeed in the past tense. I don't know if you have the Septuagint version of Ezekiel 36:28 in front of you, but since the the fathers of the house of Israel had already been deported a good, 150 years previously, that he had given them western lands already, okay? And we're talking about the migrations here. There's no doubt that the context here is the migrations, okay? So let me read verse 28 again. And you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, or that I give to your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your God, okay? Now, as you correctly pointed out, our people have yet to totally give up idolatry. We are not quite his people yet. We're still getting there. Verse 29, I will also save you from all your uncleanness, and I will call for the corn and will increase it and lay no famine upon you. Ultimately, we will never have any more famine. Verse 30, and I will multiply the fruit of the tree and the increase of the field, that you shall receive no more reproach of famine among the heathen. Now, of course, throughout European history, when we built up Europe as a civilization, we rarely had any famine. And, of course, that was right after we broke with popery. We could say that's the beginning of the industrial age, right?
I think any famine we ever had was caused by Jewish market manipulation.
Yes, right, exactly. So between the Catholics and the Jews, we had constant spiritual predators and actually literal predators preying upon our people. Verse 31, then shall you remember your own evil ways and your doings that were not good, and shall loathe yourselves in your own sight for your iniquities and for your abominations. Now, this can only, we in true Israel, Christian Israel, are the only ones admitting our iniquities.
Well, right. Mainstream Judeo-Christianity does not admit their iniquities.
Right.
And the Catholics, that they blow them off at confession with 10 Hail Marys.
Right. And then they go do it some more, right? Yeah. And so in this sense, our people have become Judaized because the Jews teach that they can do no wrong and that everything bad that happens to them is simply the anti-Semitism of the Christian world, right? They're totally innocent of anything. But these verses are telling us that we will admit to our faults, admit to our sins and our abominations. The Jews will never do that.
Well, the Jews can't have sin.
Right, they're not Israelites, right?
They never
had the law.
And they have a religion based on crime. How could they be convicted of sin?
Right, right, yeah.
Their religion, that they're not self-convicted, never.
No.
They're the world's oldest crime ring, but their religion is based on criminal activity.
But this verse absolutely proves that it can't be talking about Jews because the Jews will never loathe themselves for their iniquities, right?
Well, sin
they
is not
praise
a,
themselves
sin is not a
for their
them.
Iniquities. Yeah, please, I didn't hear you.
Sin is not a sin to them.
Right.
Yeah, you know, iniquity is not sin to them. It's wrongdoing. Their concept of wrongdoing is not taking our money.
Right.
It's not raping our daughters.
Right.
It's not molesting our little boys.
Greed is good and war is the Jews' harvest, as one rabbi put it very well, right? Okay, verse 32. Not for your sakes do I this, says Yahweh. Be it known to you, be ashamed and confounded for your own ways, O house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh, in the day that I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquities, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the wastes shall be built. Now, of course, in the short term, when the 10 tribes of the northern house migrated into Europe, Yahweh eliminated the sin of fornication because he took our people out of the area of Palestine and thereabouts where we were fornicating with the Canaanites. Okay?
Well, right. He separated our people.
Right. So by separating us from the Canaanites and sending us west into Europe, he cleansed us of Jewish and Canaanite DNA. Okay?
Well, he said we would be put through the nations like flowers of Eve.
Yeah.
Like a seed.
Yeah, like
and,
a chip,
and
exactly.
What comes out? Refined grain only comes out the other side.
Right. Very good. Verse 34, and the desolate land shall be tilled, and we're talking about the wilderness of Europe, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by, and they shall say, this land that was desolate is become like the Garden of Eden. And now the Jews have never created a Garden of Eden anywhere because they have only lived in the cities. They don't know anything else but cosmopolitan city life. They're doctors, lawyers, dentists, teachers, government bureaucrats. The Jews don't do any real work. They don't build any cities. They don't do any farming. There's no way the Jews can create a Garden of Eden. And the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. We're talking about European civilization. Look at all the great cities of Europe as the Israelites migrated west. Verse 36. Then the heathen that are left round about you shall know that I, Yahweh, build the ruined places and plant that was desolate. I, Yahweh, have spoken it, and I will do it. Okay, so the Israelites, as we moved west, we were civilization builders. 37.
Well,
and of course,
you know, we the Greeks record our people still, the Germanic people, still living in their wagons.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a prophecy in Hosea that the children of Israel would be made to live in tents like they did in the land of Egypt, right?
Right.
But they lived in what we would consider to be covered wagons.
Yes.
Tents put on top of little wooden platforms, right? And drawn about by horses and oxes.
Right.
And that's how Strabo and that's how several other ancient Greek writers describe the Germanic people. And they were still wandering in that manner, and even Julius Caesar wrote about the Germans that were always trying to get on the other side of the Rhine, right?
Right.
Squeezing their way into Gaul, and we were still wandering until the 5th century AD.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Goths, the Vandals, there was a great upheaval at that time, right?
Yeah.
And migration of people. And we wandered until the 5th, 6th century AD before we finally all basically settled down somewhere in Europe. And even then, after that, the Slavic tribes and other Germanic tribes behind us, and the Huns were white, and the Wends and the Sarmatians were pushing after us, right?
Yes.
After the Saxons.
Yes. Yeah, now the Wends and Huns are probably Japhethites, not Israelites, correct?
Well, the Huns,
yeah.
the people called the Huns by the Greeks are basically a whole assortment of people.
Okay.
The name was used far too generally, but most of them, even according to writers as late as Procopius in the 6th century, were absolutely white.
Okay.
And Procopius wasn't an armchair historian.
Right.
He was an eyewitness.
Mm-hmm.
He was the secretary to Belisarius, the great general of Justinian.
Right, right.
He was an eyewitness to the Huns, to many
yeah.
Huns,
yeah.
that fought for Belisarius, and he described them as being tall, white, fair, excellent horsemen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
and, of course, being on the Eastern Front, they had to bear the brunt of many, numerous Asian hordes.
Okay. Well, yes, even at that time.
Yes.
And they did, and he would have known the difference.
Right.
Definitely.
He
did campaign in Persia with Belisarius, and he was there. And in several battles that Belisarius fought on the east after Italy, and he had firsthand experience with all the people in the world.
Yeah.
And the Huns to him were tall, white, fair, and,
right.
and excellent horsemen.
And even today, the nation of Hungary, even though you can see the slant eyes in some of the inhabitants, the vast majority of them are still white.
Well, right.
A lot of blind.
And they've also suffered, you know, the Magyars are not the Huns first.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and the Magyars are also a people that had come from Asia who were basically white,
mm-hmm.
but some of them had mixed
right.
into Europe at a later time. In fact, the Magyars didn't come into modern-day Hungary until, I think, the 9th or 10th century.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it was a long time, and that's 300-400 years after the time of the Huns in Hungary, right?
Yes.
And maybe longer than that, maybe 500. So the Magyars throw a curve in there that the Magyars aren't the Huns, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we...
my original point was, we were still migrating and living that rudimentary pastoral life until perhaps the 6th century A.D., and by the 15th century A.D., we already had the highest civilization in Germany and Britain the world had ever seen.
Yes.
And we were every bit the equal to ancient Rome, even
right.
though we never had under Otto I and kings like that, we did have, and Charlemagne, we did have a great unified empire for short periods of time. But remember that Rome was only able to build an empire under complete pagan tyranny.
Yes.
And I wouldn't consider that one of the better points of Roman civilization, right?
Right, right. Well, it's to the benefit of credit of the Germanic Israelites that they, tried to get it. Well, they made war against the Roman Empire and resisted all its tyrannies, okay? And, in fact, that lasted until, the 1900s. That the Germanic Israelites resisted Roman tyranny, right?
Well, right. And my point is only to show that in a very brief time, when we finally settled down, we reached a very high level of civilization, having come from traveling in wagons for 1,000 years.
Yes.
From the time of the Assyrian deportations until the time of the fall of Rome, at least.
Now, I see we only have about 10 minutes left. Before I read the last two verses, it's patently obvious that the Dark Ages that were imposed upon Christendom were imposed by the papacy. There's simply no doubt about this. It's absolutely incredible that this book, the Bible, which was written by, very literate Hebrew Israelites, and then the Greeks and Romans who had their own intensely literate culture. What happened to literacy under the reign of the papacy? What happened
to it?
Well,
there was a lot of, I don't know if you really want to call it literature, but there was a great poetic tradition in the North that was wiped out by the papacy and suppressed.
Okay.
We have the Eddas and we have the Nibelungen Lied,
right.
And the Voluspa and Beowulf. But
right.
Even Beowulf and the Nibelungen Lied, although they originated at a time before the conversion of the Saxon tribes to Catholicism and Frankish tribes to Catholicism, that they still have, because scribes copied them well into the second millennium, that they still have a lot of interpolations and a heavy Christian influence that I wish they didn't have.
I wish
we had purer copies of them.
Right.
But most of the literature, we have the Saxon Chronicles, but most of the literature, because it wasn't Christian literature,
or Catholic.
Was not copied,
yeah.
Well, right, or Catholic, was not copied and preserved by the scribes.
Yeah.
It was not deemed worthy, and so we have very few copies of a very small portion of that tradition left.
Right. But certainly feudalism instituted a regime in which the farmers, under the dominance of the Catholic Church and the landowners, they had no interest in educating and furthering literacy in Europe at that time, because they were simply land slaves.
Well, absolutely. They had no right. There was no promotion of reading. The Catholic Church had actually, Bede in the he wrote in the 8th century A.D. and he said that even before his time, men were translating the Latin scriptures to the vernacular Saxon language.
Okay.
Even before his time.
Right.
But at some point, that became unlawful to do in the Catholic Church.
Right.
And at some point, it became a Latin only, and you don't get to see the scripture because you can't understand it.
Yeah, right, and we don't want you to understand it, right?
Well, right, and that happened between, I would say that had to happen between the 8th and the 11th centuries.
Okay.
I don't know exactly when because I'm not a Romish church historian.
Right.
But I'm sure that it happened sometime around the turn of the millennium.
Yeah, but the reason I bring it up is because if you study, you know, history from the secular vantage point today, it doesn't strike you that there were the civilization previous to the papacy was a highly literate civilization, okay? Highly literate civilization, and that somehow that just went away, you know?
Well right, it did. And let me say that, you know, certain historians say the Gauls of Anatolia that they didn't write in their own language. And that's true, they didn't. And I believe that comes from Polybius, but it's also mentioned by others. That now the I might be wrong, it might come from Strabo. But the Gauls of Anatolia wrote in Greek. You know, they wrote in Greek, that they were literate people. Just because they didn't write in their own language doesn't mean they weren't literate.
Yes, yes. Okay. All right.
And so, I think it's really odd. I think it's part of the curse of our blindness that those Gauls didn't write in their own language, right?
Yes, yes, right. Well, and two, I suppose we can say that while the Israelites were transversing, you know, the wilderness of Europe, it was hard to keep records, right? They didn't have books, you know, and they had to leave stuff behind and, you know, probably lost some of their literacy.
Right, they certainly didn't have the paper-making capability of the Roman Roman world, but parchment was a possibility, right?
Yes, yes. Okay, all right. Two more verses in chapter 36, verse 37. Thus says Yahweh, I will yet for this be inquired of by the house of Israel to do it for them. I will increase them with men like a flock. Now, this verse, this is the verse that we've been prefacing our 888 and 999 events, because Yahweh is telling us we must make the inquiry of Yahweh to do these things for us. Ask and ye shall receive, right?
Absolutely.
If we don't ask, we're not going to get what we need, what we want. Verse 38, as the holy flock, as the flock of Jerusalem in her solemn feasts, so shall the waste cities be filled with flocks of men, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Now, of course, your mainstream Judeo churches, you know, simply assume that big cities, you know, were, you know, brought about by all men. No, it's not true. It's the Israelites of these prophecies who brought in all of this civilization.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Every bit of it. And here we basically have a promise that no matter how many Negroes and Mexicans overrun us, that eventually we shall prevail.
That's right.
And we'll see that absolutely in the chapters which follow.
Yeah.
And I would say that, yeah, you know, your contention about this verse, it is corroborated at 2 Chronicles 7:14. If my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways,
right,
then will I hear them and forgive their sin, and then I will heal their land.
Right, right, yeah. So we have to make the call. We have to respond to Yahweh according to his will, what he expects of us.
And stop loving the fag next door and the
right.
race mixers that live on the other side of you.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, very good. So we have progressed through chapter 36, and I think next week, 37 is another long chapter. And but we definitely will go into 37, and we have the Valley of the Dry Bones and the Two Sticks Prophecy. And with regard to the Two Sticks Prophecy, we have to address the Joseph Scepter heresy and, you know, prove to them that Judah, the house of Judah.
Well, right. I was hoping to have some fun with that tonight. But
yeah,
I guess
we will definitely have fun with that next week, okay? Definitely. And chapter 37 of Ezekiel is just loaded with prophecy, a very good prophecy, and also 38 and 39. The really good stuff is coming up, folks. Here we go. All right. Thank you all for listening. Pastor Eli James signing off. Thank you, Bill, for joining me again. Tomorrow night we are going to do the Epistle
Jude.
Of Jude. Okay.
And some outtakes from Enoch chapters 10 and 11, I think.
Okay. And then whatever suits the Epistle of Jude, I think we can talk about the fallen angels as well.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of material there.
Yes. Very good. All right. Thank you for joining me again tonight. Thank you all for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, Christian Israel, Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Good night.
Oh, I'm an hour late.